I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. For decades, many have tried to bring peace in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Some have found fleeting success, but more have failed. Former U.S. Senator George Mitchell served as special envoy for Middle East peace, and he still holds out hope. Today he'll tell us why and what impact the American election may have. Then, this is the age of the algorithm. Mathematical models affect every part of our lives, from getting a car loan to where our kids go to school. But one data scientist says these models create a toxic cocktail for democracy. We'll find out why. Also, Bill Brownlee joins us with this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. He held the reins of the Senate at a less divisive time. He brokered an agreement that brought peace to Northern Ireland. And then he went to the Middle East. Hope and harmony weren't really the outcome there, but that doesn't mean he's given up on the possibilities. George Mitchell joins us today from the NPR Bureau in New York City. His latest book's title expresses the optimism he has for the region. It's called A Path to Peace. Senator Mitchell, welcome to Up to Date.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. So the very first scene you describe in your book pits a very frustrated Israeli prime minister against an ambitious and assertive American president. But then you reveal that you're not talking about President Obama and Benjamin Netanyahu. You're talking about Menachem Begin and Ronald Reagan in 1982. And a lot of people look at the Middle East and say, gosh, you know, they've been fighting for centuries. It'll never be solved. What do you say when you hear things like that?
That's what they said about Northern Ireland, that they'd been fighting for 800 years and that the many prior efforts to achieve an agreement had failed. But ultimately, peace did prevail and has held largely now for 18 years. And I believe that in the Middle East, although there have been many failures, 12 presidents and 20 secretaries of states have served and tried to resolve this issue since the creation of the State of Israel. But in the end, I believe the pursuit of peace is so important that we have to keep at it. And most importantly, I think it is so clearly in the interests of the people of Israel and the Palestinian territories, in their self-interest, that the best course is to reach an agreement that would provide for the people of Israel the security that they want and deserve, and the Palestinians the state that they want and ought to have. And as President George W. Bush said in a very persuasive speech in Jerusalem in 2008, speaking to both Israeli and Palestinian leaders, Israel's not going to get what it wants until the Palestinians get what they want, and the Palestinians aren't going to get what they want until the Israelis get what they want. So each, he argued, should be vested not only in getting what they want, but what the other wants as well.
You mentioned that this has been going on under every president since the middle of the last century. And, of course, the first of those presidents when Israel was established was Harry Truman from here in Kansas City. And you've pointed out that even though he started the close relationship between the U.S. and Israel, that wasn't necessarily a sure thing from the beginning. Why wasn't it?
Well, Israel and the United States are two vibrant democracies. We have a close relationship, extraordinarily close. The United States has a relationship, of course, with most of the nearly 200 countries in the world. But we guarantee Israel's safety and security. But there are differences of opinion. Truman had differences of opinion. Eisenhower had a tremendously bitter difference of opinion with then Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion. Eisenhower threatened to sever the relationship, to go to the UN and get a resolution against Israel. There were very hard feelings between President Ronald Reagan and Prime Minister Begin that you referred to briefly in your comments. Reagan wanted and did propose a plan that Begin vehemently denounced and angrily attacked President Reagan. Clinton and Netanyahu didn't get along, but they were able to reach a couple of agreements. And so the much is made of the differences between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu. it's a forgetting history and recognizing that the relationship is between the two peoples and the two countries, not necessarily or exclusively between the two leaders. And while it helps to have leaders that get along, it's not essential to the continuation of the relationship. And President Obama has, in fact, done a great deal in support of Israel. Indeed, he is the only president in the last few decades under whom no Security Council resolution at the UN critical of Israel has been passed. Not one. There were more than a dozen under President Reagan. There were several under both Presidents Bush and under President Clinton. There'd been none under President Obama because he's been at the UN a very firm and staunch ally of Israel.
You talk about the relationships between peoples, and of course it is the relationship between the Israeli people and the Palestinian people that is most at stake in these conversations. Each of them have histories, each of them have narratives, and you write about the ways that often the way those peoples tell their own stories, tell their narrative, involves negating the story of the other group. Can you say more about that? Why does that happen? Why is that the way that they find themselves telling their stories?
That is not unique to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Indeed, I think that's probably common in most conflicts. Certainly was the case in Northern Ireland, also was the case in the Balkans, where I was very much involved at one point in time. The fact is, of course, that both sides have been victims at various times in their history by various others. And this deep and profound sense of victimization tends to loosen the restraints that one has upon what one may do or authorize or sanction or condone. It exists on both sides. There is justification on both sides. Indeed, both have been victimized in the past for a variety of reasons and a variety of circumstances, not in any equivalent sense, but there has been some degree on all sides. And it's hard to move past that. We see in our own country polarization and deep divisions, the stereotyping of groups. One or two members of a group commit violent acts, and there is a tendency to blame the whole group. There's this stereotyping. So it's hard to overcome. The answer is, of course, not to suggest that people erase or forget history. That's always a part of every society and every individual. It is to look beyond history to the future, so that instead of thinking what our grandparents did, let's start thinking about what our grandchildren will do. There has to be a way to turn people's thoughts, minds, efforts, and energies to the future as a past, as opposed to a constant reliving and relitigating of the past.
You're being very complimentary of President Obama's leadership. At the time you left the position of Middle East envoy back in 2011, there was some disagreement over the right next steps. Are you satisfied or appreciative of the way the Obama administration has conducted its role, the U.S. role, in trying to bring resolution to this conflict in the years since you left that role, the last 5 years?
Well, I support President Obama. I served in his administration, but he's made mistakes, as has every president, as has every human being. Being human means being imperfect, and any president, given the terrifically difficult and complex problems that they have, is not going to have a perfect record.
What would you have done differently?
I think the president's major mistakes were with respect to Syria, which affected his standing throughout the region and the world. I don't think he should have drawn a red line with respect to the use of chemical weapons in Syria. But having drawn a red line, I think he should have acted when the red line was crossed. Most people have forgotten that during the Reagan administration, Saddam Hussein in Iraq used poison gas extensively against his own people and against his enemies. The Reagan administration supported Saddam Hussein. There wasn't any peep out of Americans critical of gas at that time. I don't think the red line made sense, although I'm personally strongly opposed to the Assad regime. But I think it was an error, and I think it affected both the president's standing and our country's standing in the region. Overall, I think the president has done a pretty good job, as is reflected in his high favorable rating among the American people for presidents at this time in his status. But no one would argue, I doubt the president himself would argue, that his tenure in office has been free of error.
You're listening to KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in today for Steve Kraske, and we're talking with former Senator George Mitchell, former U.S. Special envoy for Middle East peace, about his book, A Path to Peace, which he co-authored with Alan Sakhar. Senator Mitchell, you, in this book, lay out a peace plan, and it has two parts. The first is a statement that you'd like to see President Obama make before he leaves office. What is it you want him to say?
Before he left office, President Clinton made a statement of his assessment of the situation at the time and what he regarded as, later became known as, the parameters. He didn't call them that, the parameters for discussion in the region. President Bush made a, George W. Bush made a very important statement in Jerusalem before he left office, actually quite a while before he left office, and he previously had offered a detailed written plan called the Roadmap for Peace, which is identified with him, both of which represented their assessments of how best to proceed. I think that President Obama should do the same, provide an assessment of the situation, offer suggestions for the way forward. We set some up in our Alone and I set them up in the book. And we wrote the book before the presidential election, so it was addressed to whoever is elected. We hope that the president-elect will take on some of the suggestions that we made for how to create incentives to encourage Israelis and Palestinians to re-enter negotiations in a way that provides some hope for the agreement on a two-state solution. I would say, Brian, that a principal thrust of our book is to provide support for the concept of a two-state solution. We don't think there's any other viable or feasible alternative. While the two-state solution is much criticized because it has so far been unattainable, we think it survives precisely because there isn't any other realistic alternative, and we hope that the president-elect will continue American policy in that respect. That has been our policy for quite a long time. And we think that's a very important first step.
As you say, a lot of folks say that the two-state solution is, if not dead, a dying prospect. Former President Jimmy Carter yesterday wrote in the New York Times that to keep the hope of a two-state solution alive, the U.S. should actually recognize the state of Palestine right now. What do you say to that?
I respect President Carter. He was one of the major contributors to peace in the region. He brokered the huge agreement between Israel and Egypt, which has endured to this day. President Clinton later brokered the peace between Israel and Jordan, which also has survived. But I think it's premature for the United States to, at this time, recognize a Palestinian state. It is true that 137 other countries have done so. But there is only one United States. We are not one of 138. We are the dominant power in the world. The United States government will have to play a major role in the resolution of this conflict. And it has been American policy for several decades that we will not unilaterally decide and impose upon Israelis and Palestinians how to resolve the major issues that lie between them. And one of them, of course, is the existence and nature of a Palestinian state. So I think we're best to stick with the policy that we've had of encouraging negotiations, being supportive of the aspirations of both, but also recognizing that there have to be important, very important negotiations and concessions by both sides to achieve a common agreement.
And the rest of your plan that you suggest in the book deals with things that the next president, and who we now know will be President Trump, will have to negotiate and work out. I'm curious, since you wrote the book before the election, since the election, what are your thoughts? Do you think that President Trump is going to lead the United States policy in the region in a healthy direction?
He has not disclosed the direction that he intends to take, and so there's no way of answering that question. But he has said several times that he regards this as an important issue, that he thinks that he'd like to, in his words, make a deal there, and it would be a good deal, he said, although he also said that many have told him it's impossible. He wants to try. I hope he does try. I hope and pray that he does succeed, and he will have my full encouragement and support, although the details of the policy, what the objectives are, what the processes by which it will be accomplished, remain yet unknown.
Stepping away from the Middle East specifically, you, of course, served as the Senate Democratic leader for many years. You were senator for 15 years. The world has changed somewhat since then. As you look at the state of political affairs, what are your reflections? Are you concerned about the tone and the direction of things in Washington these days?
Well, the world has changed in a lot of ways since I was Senate Majority Leader. You get up every morning now, as do most of your listeners, and check their cell phone. That didn't exist in our time, so it's moving very rapidly. American politics has always been rough and tumble. The campaign for president of 1800 between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams was a very rough campaign. What is different now, of course, is the power of electronic media, this microphone into which I'm now speaking, the television cameras, and dramatically social media, which in just a few years have really upended the norms of our society, and particularly the norms to the extent that they existed of journalism. So we have a deepening polarization in our society, a massive inflow of money into the political process, not started but abetted by the Supreme Court in a series of erroneous decisions, best known as the Citizens United case, which have triggered two unhealthy results. First, a massive increase in the amount of money flowing into the political process, but it's simultaneously a dramatic reduction in the transparency. Who gives what to whom? Most Americans will never know where millions, perhaps tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, where they came from, where it came from, and who it went to, and for what purpose in the recent campaign. That's very destructive of democracy. So it is quite a bit more polarized. When I was elected Senate Majority Leader, the first person I called was Bob Dole, who was the Republican leader. I went to see him, and I said to him, these are tough jobs, and there has to be some trust between us. I told him how I intended to behave toward him, and I set out the most basic and simple standards of decency and honesty and fair play. He was delighted. We shook hands, and to this very moment, not once ever, has a harsh word passed between Bob Dole and me, in public or in private. We disagreed every day on most bills. We had vigorous debates, but we didn't make it personal. And when we couldn't agree to negotiate something, we left it for the Senate to decide. Sometimes my view prevailed, sometimes his view prevailed. But we conducted it as though the highest priority was the national interest, not the interest of the party that we represented. Despite our loyalties to our colleagues, he to the Republican senators, I to the Democratic senators, we recognized that was, while real, it was secondary to a higher priority, which is the national interest.
And I mean, would you even want to serve in the Senate today?
Not at this time, frankly. It's pretty tough. I admire most of the senators. I don't think they like the system. I don't think they personally like the process. It certainly can't be rewarding or fulfilling. Most of these are accomplished, ambitious, and intelligent, and many aggressive men and women who want to do something meaningful in and with their lives, not just have the title of senator, but accomplish something that is good for the country. And when you find yourself in a situation where hardly anything is done, very few bills are passed, there are very few votes, it's very frustrating for many of them. I know a lot of them. I talk with them privately, and there is a sense of being frustrated and sometimes demeaned in the process.
You know, you have developed quite a reputation since your service in the Senate as a negotiator, as a peacemaker, because of Northern Ireland, as you mentioned, because of various situations where you've come in and been the trusted broker. How do you do that? What is essential? Because you are a politician. I mean, you have a public record. People know your views on things. Yet somehow you're able to come in and be an honest broker. How is that accomplished?
I don't have any magic formula. I have no formal training in mediation, but my service as Senate Majority Leader was sure a good lesson to me. I think the first thing you have to do is subordinate your own ego and recognize that the dispute you're trying to resolve is not about you. It's about others, other people who are involved, other issues. The second is to have a capacity to listen. It's a very tough thing in our society. Most people don't listen, actually. If you think about social conversations, you talk, and then when someone else starts speaking, half of your mind is thinking about what you're going to say next, and the other half is only vaguely listening to others. Listening, really listening, especially to people you don't like and don't agree with, is very hard to do. I did acquire that ability, and it served me well in Northern Ireland, where I, over a span of 5 years, I chaired three separate sets of negotiations between men and women who had spent their entire lives in conflict, some of whom had been shot, some of whom had been guilty of murder. During our negotiations, two delegates of the peace talks were assassinated. It was a very violent overlay, and men and women who had been in conflict for a long time, but over time, by listening to them, by encouraging them to speak their minds, by trying to get them to see the other side not as members of a hostile tribe, but as fellow human beings with families and dogs and personal issues similar to theirs. Ultimately, the real heroes, of course, are the people and the leaders of Northern Ireland who, at a moment of crisis in their society, had the courage to take a major step forward and achieve peace at huge risk to themselves personally and politically. Indeed, some of them, their careers came to an end almost immediately. But for 18 years now, there's been peace, and I hope it lasts for a very long time.
Do you see people rising through the system or in the United States or elsewhere who have that kind of authority or at least that ability to bring people together in the way that you were able to in Northern Ireland and that you have tried to do in other places?
It's very difficult in a polarized political process where the standard approach now is to demean, insult, and hurl invective at your opponent rather than presenting and discussing in a rational way resolutions or proposed resolutions to the serious issues facing our country. In that way, you had this last election where for the first time in history both candidates had negative ratings in excess of 50%. That is, a majority of Americans did not like or trust either of the candidates at the time of the election. That's a very unfortunate thing. It's corruptive of democracy because, particularly with all the money involved, people no longer trust their public officials to do what's in the public interest, but rather they think they're doing it in response to special interests. That is corrosive because democracy can't function effectively if there's no trust between the people and those they elect.
It sounds like the United States itself might need a peacemaker. Do you have some advice for Americans who find themselves deeply conflicted with each other in the wake of the election?
Well, I think it goes back to what I said before. First, we have to recognize we are all fallible. And all of us make mistakes. The human being has not lived who didn't make mistakes. Secondly, we have to acknowledge that no one of us is the source of all wisdom, right, and good in the world. You have to be able to listen to people you disagree with. That's a hard thing. I'm not a scientist, so I can't describe it in scientific terms, but I can tell you it's absolutely the case that human beings tend to accept well, retain and use information that's consistent with their prior beliefs. But they receive very poorly, they don't retain, and they don't use information that's inconsistent with their prior beliefs. Indeed, that can be a source of political strength, the capacity to have a closed mind, to regard not as fact anything with which you disagree, and to state things that are demonstrably untrue, proven untrue, but to believe in them is a way of conveying conviction and strength. It's a very difficult task in the modern political arena to develop that and succeed and at the same time retain the ability to be understanding, respectful, and listen carefully to those with whom you disagree.
Senator, what's next for you? Do you have another peacemaking project or venture in you, or working on anything else?
I'm going through the toughest time of my life. I married and had children late in life, and I have two teenage kids. And the Irish and the Israelis and the Palestinians all seem pretty easy to me compared to dealing with them on a day. They're wonderful kids, I must say. I don't want to leave a bad impression. I have a 19-year-old son who's a freshman in college and a 15-year-old daughter who's a sophomore in high school. And my wife and I love them dearly, but boy, it is sure a test of leadership to get through these difficult teenage years.
Well, I think everyone will agree you have plenty on your plate here at home. So that's George Mitchell. He's the former U.S. Special Envoy for Middle East Peace and former Senate Majority Leader, co-author with Alon Sarkar of A Path to Peace. Senator, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Brian.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll find out how something as seemingly objective as an algorithm can lead us astray and maybe even reinforce societal inequity. The dangers of math. When we come back, I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, we talked about election aftermath with David Vondrely of Time Magazine and also talked with folks raising HIV awareness among Kansas City's black community. You can find those conversations online at kcur.org/up-to-date. You can join us tomorrow. The ethics professors will discuss current moral dilemmas like teachers wearing safety pins, free speech and school district policy, and more. We'll be looking for your thoughts on that issue tomorrow. Today, how much of your destiny and of the destinies of some of society's most vulnerable people is being determined by math? Kathy O'Neill has always loved math, so much so that she's made it her job. Now she's sharing the lessons she's learned in her career as a data scientist in her latest book, Weapons of Math Destruction. She joins us from NPR in New York City. Kathy, welcome to Up to Date.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. So before we get to what you've written about, can we just take a step back? I admit that I'm not really a math person, but at what point growing up did you say to yourself, you know, what I want to do is get a PhD from Harvard in math?
I think the answer to that question is I started becoming obsessed with the concept of prime numbers when I was playing with spirographs when I was 5 years old.
I remember spirographs.
Spirographs are cool. I remember like understanding periodicity and how if you put your little pen in those different little holes, you would have different kinds of periods of repetition. Yes. Of the different patterns. And like if you had a sixfold pattern versus a threefold pattern, then they would kind of overlap in certain ways. And so, I mean, I became very interested in these sort of patterns in nature and mathematics quite early on. I think I didn't decide to become a mathematician until I went to a math camp the summer after my ninth grade. And that's when I really said, this is my thing. I learned how to solve the Rubik's Cube using group theory that summer. And that was the end of that story.
Math camp. I'm just pausing there for a moment, but all right.
Yeah.
you ended up on the tenure track at Barnard College. Then you went to the private sector and you were making big financial decisions for a hedge fund. And then the 2008 housing crash happened. How important was that moment for you?
Well, it was huge, actually. And I should mention that I entered the hedge fund D.E. Shaw in 2007 in June. And actually, I know the rest of the world sort of probably didn't notice the financial crisis till, you know, August 2008 when Lehman Brothers fell and we needed to bail out, you know, AIG and all those companies. But actually, within finance, it started a year earlier in August 2007.
So you actually entered during the crash, basically.
I entered right before the crash. So everybody was sort of at maximal smugness when I got there. And I remember like people would look at me with disdain when I asked stupid questions like, you know, what if we don't always have infinite liquidity? And then suddenly, boom, the financial crisis erupted within finance and everybody's assumptions were wiped away. And it was very telling. It was very disillusioning for me because as a sort of very naive math nerd, I'd hoped to like use the mathematics, the truth and clarity, the truth-telling potential of mathematics that I love so much. I hope to port that to the financial sector and sort of bring truth to the world through finance. And of course, what everybody realized quite soon and within finance even sooner was that was exactly the opposite of what had actually been done with mathematical modeling. To a large extent, I think you could blame the AAA ratings on mortgage-backed securities for that, for the scale of the mortgage bubble. And those AAA ratings were more or less mathematical models that were untrue. They were sort of, by construction, misleading mathematical lies. And
okay.
So it was it was very disillusioning for me. In fact, I was ashamed of myself and of mathematics, of mathematicians for doing that.
And that's really what your book is about, is these models, as you say, that appear to be helpful instruments for figuring stuff out, but in fact cause a lot of problems. What is a model?
A model is basically a process to decide things. I'm trying to be very, very abstract because it's it's not scary. People think of it as so hard and mathematical, and since they didn't do very well in math in high school or something, they're I'm not an expert enough to understand this. But at the end of the day, I mean, there are technical things that go into creating a model, but it's very easy to understand what a model actually does. What a model does is it takes historical data, looks for patterns, what used to happen in this situation historically, then we're going to assume the same exact thing is going to happen now. And that's all it does.
So give us an example of a good use of a mathematical model in the world.
Well, one of the examples I talk about in my book of a really perfectly good use is mathematics, statistics in sports, like the whole Moneyball thing. I think that's fun. I'm a baseball fan myself, and I love thinking about what is it about a player that is really valuable? Is it when they can hit a lot of home runs? But what if they strike out a lot? That's not good. That kind of question it's fun. It doesn't harm anyone. And kind of the best thing about it is it's open to everyone. It's transparent. Everyone gets to play that game. And the data itself is completely open. Everybody gets to argue about whether a given team got a run. It's actually televised on national television. That's to contrast it to many of the other very secret, secretive, opaque systems of decision making that I talk about in my book.
Like what?
Well, I guess an example, one of the ones that sort of hit me over the head that made me want to write this book was this sort of assessments on teachers called the teacher value added model. And this is part of a long, long history of education reform in this country, starting with No Child Left Behind and then Race to the Top. It's sort of a very extended history, which I won't go into.
But the idea is that in order to improve our schools, we have to make sure we have the best teachers and that we're getting rid of the bad ones.
That's exactly right. So the question is, how do you find the bad ones to get rid of them? And the idea is, well, let's assess them using data. At the end of the day, these were scores that were between 0 and 100, and they weren't explained. It was a very non-transparent process, but it was high stakes. And it was just terrible statistics. So I found a teacher in New York City named Tim Clifford who got a 6 out of 100 one year. And then he got a 96 the next year. He didn't change his teaching style.
So how does that happen?
In spite of that, how does that happen? It's just bad statistics. I mean, I can tell you why I think it's bad statistics. And the very short version is there's just too much uncertainty. What you're doing is you're taking all the kids in your class and their expected scores for the end of the year. The expected scores have uncertainty. And then you're comparing those expected scores to the actual scores, which also have a lot of uncertainty, statistically speaking. So if Johnny's expected to get a 70, but he actually gets a 75, then you're given credit for those 5 points. If he's expected to get 70, but he gets a 65, then you're on the hook for those 5 points. But since both of those numbers have so much uncertainty, you're really on the hook for kind of random numbers. And when you have 25 random numbers corresponding to 25 students in your class, then it's actually kind of random. 25 random numbers give you a random number.
Which is all very interesting, except that these teachers' jobs are on the line as a result of these numbers.
Absolutely. And I interviewed somebody named Sarah Wasaki, who was working under Michelle Rhee's you know, Michelle Rhee being the school chancellor in Washington, D.C., she was working in one of the public schools at the time, and she got fired for her teacher assessment, which was 50% due to this teacher value added model. So we had high stakes attached to these almost random numbers. And it was like not okay.
Another example you use in this realm that I think a lot of listeners will recognize is the U.S. News ranking of colleges and universities. But as we've heard in many reports, that's a ranking system that is often gamed by schools. How does that what is causing that? Why is it open to that kind of gaming?
Okay, so I talked about like the opacity problem, the fact that we don't quite understand how these things work. The problem in this case with U.S. News and World Report college ranking is that, you know, it started out as being unimportant and no one cared, but suddenly parents started caring about this. And when parents really cared and parents wanted their kids to go to the highly ranked schools, then school administrators started caring. And it was relatively opaque to a given parent who only picked it up, you know, once their kid was a senior and in college, in high school, I should say. But it wasn't, if you really paid attention to it and got as much information as possible, then for a college administrator, it wasn't completely opaque what the model was made up of, and in particular because one of the largest categories of data going into it was what's called like a reputation score, where college administrators were asked to rank other colleges. So they actually played a part in that scoring system. But in any case, they learned all they could about it, and they started, deforming themselves to look prettier to the U.S. college, U.S. News and World Report ranking system. And the problem, of course, is that the U.S. News and World ranking system, it doesn't have terrible choices for what makes a college look good. Like one of them is like, how hard is it to get into? Another one is, how many people who you offer positions to actually show up? Those don't seem like completely terrible proxies for a high quality college. But one thing that they did not use, and which was a real mistake, a blind spot that they sort of created when they created the whole scoring system, was cost, tuition. And so what it meant when the college administrators were gaming themselves, changing themselves, deforming themselves to make themselves look better, they didn't care how much it added to the tuition bill. So, and that's sort of a normal, it's a sort of a general fact. When you contort yourself to look good for a specific system with the specific proxies, then things that are missing will just get wildly large. And I think that's one of the large reasons we see so much of a tuition increase especially for the sort of highly ranked colleges.
We're talking with Kathy O'Neill. She's the author of Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy, here on KCUR's Up to Date. And Kathy, I'm hearing a lot about bad math, but I'm not sure we've reached the level of weapons of math destruction quite yet. Modeling, though, you write, is also used to help judges determine criminal sentencing in courts. Can you talk about that? How does math come into play there?
Sure. They have something called recidivism risk scores. Judges are given a score for a given criminal defendant, and they use it to determine how long sentencing would last. And so recidivism risk, I should mention, is the sort of risk that a given person after leaving prison will return to prison. And since 97% of prisoners eventually leave prison, it's a pertinent question. Like, are they going to come back? So they're assessed for this risk, like either high, medium, or low risk. And the judges are shown that score. And they give defendants longer sentencing if they're high risk, which is already troubling if you think about it, because what you're doing is you're sort of preemptively punishing somebody for something they haven't done yet.
I'm thinking of the movie Minority Report.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's definitely got a Minority Report edge to it. That's already problematic. But what I was worried about, and what I'm still worried about, is that the scores themselves are created with data that is racially biased. And it's also class. It's biased by class. So the questions that are asked in the questionnaire, for example, are very much proxies for race and class. They ask questions like, did you have a job? Do you live in a high crime neighborhood? Given the way we police in this country, we over-police poor minority neighborhoods. These questions basically become the question: are you poor and minority? And when you give somebody a higher risk score because they're poor minority, they end up in prison for longer because they're higher risk, And that actually, if you think about it, being in prison longer doesn't help anybody. It actually, when they, by the time they leave, they are in fact worse off. They have fewer ties to their community. They have fewer job opportunities.
Which causes those risk factors to statistically keep growing, raising those numbers for the next person to be assessed.
For the next person and for themselves. And so it creates this pernicious feedback loop. And that's part of the characterization of a weapon of mass destruction in my book.
Is there a better model, or should this just be the kind of thing that an algorithm, that a mathematical formula isn't used for at all?
Well, I actually think that same exact use, I mean, that is, sorry, not the same use, but the same algorithm could be used in a very positive way. And so here comes the part where I tell you how much I love data and I love algorithms. But the truth is, like, we could be using that same model to ask the question, why is it that Black people are so much more likely to end up back in prison? Why is it that poor people are so much more likely to end back up in prison? What is it that, what's the intervention we need to perform to keep them safe, to keep them, you know, on the narrow road? But instead of asking that question, like, what societal level adjustments do we need to make to give them a support system, we choose to assign them the blame. We choose, once they've been scored, it is their fault. Mm-hmm. Even though many of the factors that go into this risk score are way beyond their control. They have to do with where they were born.
So one really significant place that algorithms have been in the news lately, whether we're using that word or not, is in conversations about social media and how Facebook or Twitter distributes news content or what is sometimes called fake news. How does that work? How is math determining what I see on my Facebook feed, for example?
Well, the Facebook feed was designed a long time ago with the idea that you would like to see news that your friends like to see. I mean, that was a very important design decision.
Which seems true enough, right?
It seemed reasonable enough at the time. I think they could adjust it. I just throw that out there if anybody at Facebook is listening. but what it meant was that people essentially started building echo chambers of their friends and their friends' voices. And as we know a lot about echo chambers at this point. So we know that people who are louder and more vehement were heard more. And, you know, people on the left had their left echo chambers. People on the right had their right echo chambers. And these became more and more hyper-partisan over time. And this is something that has been documented for 5 years. Eli Pariser wrote a book called Filter Bubbles, which was essentially a precursor to my book, because he mentioned we're going to become less and less able to talk to each other. Absolutely true. And then on top of that, more recently, what we've had is political micro-targeting, which I talk about in my book at length, which is the idea that you can place ads. Of course, Facebook is an ad company, right? That's how it makes its money. You can place ads where you get to profile the person who's targeted by these ads, and you get to say exactly what you want them to hear. Right. And what happens when you start develop technology like that, and of course, political campaigns do it, but everyone else does it too, is that it becomes less and less about the topics, the policies, and less about sort of reasonably scrutinizing, putting like two politicians next to each other and saying, what's your opinion on this topic A and what's your opinion on topic A, and comparing them in kind of rational sense. It becomes much more about manipulation and showing the side that you think will be convincing to the other person. And it becomes less and less of a civil conversation. And that's what
we've seen. Kathy, I'm so sorry that we have to leave it there, but you've scratched the surface for us, and it's a fascinating book, which I hope folks will check out. Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. Kathy O'Neill also is author of the blog mathbabe.org. Kathy, thanks so much for being with us today.
It was really my pleasure. Thank you.
KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is in the studio for our local listen. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Good to see you again. What do you have for us this week?
Well, I am embarrassed to say that over the weekend, my wife put up Christmas lights at our home all by herself.
all by herself.
And had I listened to the snow globes in advance, maybe I would have been in the mood to help her.
The snow globes, the name even suggests that this is a holiday sort of group.
The snow globes is a Kansas City-based trio that comes together every December to play holiday songs, both original and old favorites.
Well, let's see what they sound like. So what are we hearing here, Bill?
Well, as the listeners can hear for themselves, we've got a rewrite, sort of the holiday classic, Baby, It's Cold Outside.
Right. You should stay. No, I need to go.
That's right. And so it's cute, it's sultry, and it just feels really nice to me.
It's a lovely sound, but they only play this together once a year, it sounds like.
That's right. This song was co-written by the vocalist Lindsey Jones, and the other man you hear singing there is Barkley Martin, who is a prominent folk-based artist in Kansas City, and he plays, you know, secular music all year long.
I think we've had Barkley Martin on this show, in fact. What are they doing when they're not in this band? He's playing on his own, or?
Right. Barkley is known for his many philanthropic endeavors. In fact, there's a charitable component to the Snow Globes as well. Lindsey's a fine vocalist in other formats, and bassist Rick Willoughby, the other member of the group, plays in lots of contexts, including jazz groups.
This is an original piece, but there are, in fact, some traditional favorites on the album as well.
Right. Well, this is an older song, but they have a brand new album coming out tomorrow to coincide with the show that is at a church in Overland Park. And the new album, Snowed In, has lots of old favorites like Let It Snow and Sleigh Ride. So their shows are a mix of both original material and familiar songs.
What do you like about this, Bill? I mean, I love that it's not the same old Christmas sound, but there's still something comforting and warm about it.
Yeah, if I heard this in July, Brian, you know, I would, find whatever, you know, I would immediately turn it off. You know, it's a little bit twee and a little bit precious, but that works in December, I think. Even though we're one day short, I'm there listening to this now.
I need to find more uses for the word twee in my life. So thank you. The Snow Globes perform a free concert at Christ Church Anglican at 7 p.m. on Thursday night, tomorrow night. Bill Brownlee, KCUR contributor, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Brian.
That is our show for today. You can listen to previous programs and download our podcasts at kcur.org/uptodate. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR UpToDate, and I'm at PTS Brian. Tomorrow, Steve Kraske will be back. Safety pins in Shawnee Mission schools have become a symbol of safety, or are they a political protest against the president-elect? We'll bring in the ethics professors for this one, so we hope you can join us. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, Ryan Hennessy, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.